Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. We are always privileged to be able to speak about such weighty topics with our first guest. His name is Gordon Chang. He is one of our country's preeminent authorities on all matters involving Asia, but most especially the Chinese Communist Party, what it's up to, the magnitude of the threat it poses to us, and what we had best be doing about it. These are subjects of innumerable articles and a few very important books by Gordon Chang, including The Coming Collapse of China. And you can follow his essays at places like Newsweek and the Gatestone Institute. And always follow him on Twitter, as I do, at Gordon G. Chang. It's great to have you with us, Gordon. Welcome back.
Thank you so much, Frank.
A lot to talk about, Gordon. At the moment, we have an election taking place as we speak in South Korea, and I want to come back to that in a moment. But before we do, I really want to drill down with you on what you think is the upshot as far as the Chinese Communist Party is concerned of its ally, Vladimir Putin, and his invasion of Ukraine.
Well, I think the Chinese right now are surprised that the invasion has stalled and that a small country is now getting the better of a big country. The Chinese view has always been that big countries can do whatever they want and small countries must obey. And right now, that is not proving to be the case. This is important, of course, because it's an issue of whether China will be able to roll over Taiwan or India or Japan or the Philippines or Bhutan or Nepal, because they are seeing heroic resistance in Ukraine, and they should be thinking about heroic resistance against their territorial ambitions and designs. And clearly the Taiwan people right now are thinking the same thing as they are starting to organize themselves for self-defense, like the Ukrainians did.
Gordon, as you see what China is doing, do you anticipate that they are taking away one other lesson, which is if you are going to attack another nation, in this case, let's say Taiwan, you had best use overwhelming force? And if so, are they capable of bringing that kind of force to bear, do you think, against Taiwan, given especially any uncertainties about how the United States and its allies might respond?
Ever since the Gulf War, Chinese military doctrine has been overwhelming force, shock and awe. But I don't think they can do that with regard to Taiwan. The Taiwan Strait at its narrowest point is 81 miles. In other points, it's far wider. And China has not had success in military operations that are complex. The last time it tried anything, its first string got beaten by Vietnam's third string. And the problem for the Chinese military is that it has two lines of control, both a political one and a military one. And between the two, the political one is far more important. That's not very good for operations. So although China does have the balance, a favorable balance of power with regard to Taiwan, I don't think that they would be able, at least on their first try, to be extremely successful in the first hours in a combined operation against Taiwan, especially now with Taiwan taking its defense more seriously.
And as you see that developing, Gordon, it's heartening to hear. Is it likely to be too little too late, do you think, if the Chinese are determined to move quickly? And how has their timetable for an attack on Taiwan or other coercive pressure on it, if not an outright attack, been affected, do you think, by what they've been seeing their ally Vladimir Putin facing in Ukraine?
China is studying Ukraine extremely closely, more closely than any other country. But at this year, China is inward focused. If the schedule holds, there'll be the 20th National Party Congress sometime in October or November, an extremely important event. We're seeing all signs that Xi Jinping is in trouble politically. And so he's focused, I think, on getting that third term. So although anything can happen, Frank, I think that 2022 is a year which looks relatively safe. I do believe, though, that if there is going to be a military operation, the place that I would be looking at is India, where China is building up its forces. It has an advantage there. It is also fighting downhill, literally. And this is where, you know, they've seen military operations in the past, going back to May 2020. But that May 2020 attack on India was not a sterling success. I think China right now is thinking about how to do this, and it has not yet to come up with answers.
I want to come back to India. This is really important, Gordon, but just staying with the internal dynamics of the political challenges to Xi Jinping, isn't it often the case that when tyrants like him get into political trouble, they manufacture an external crisis and seek to bolster their claim to legitimacy, or at least their hold on power, by saying, you know, you will need to rally around the flag, boys, and, you know, stand shoulder to shoulder against this enemy, whether it's legitimate or not. And does that not suggest that it's a risky question, I grant you, but that we might well see Xi acting militarily in this circumstance precisely because he seeks to consolidate his hold on power?
That's a possibility, Frank. And to make this even worse, you've got two leaders right now who have a lot of incentive to lash out. Vladimir Putin, whose invasion is stalling, as well as Xi Jinping, who's in trouble at home. The problem in China, though, for Xi Jinping is that if he were to launch an invasion of Taiwan, he'd have to give some general or admiral almost total control over the Chinese military. And it makes that general officer the most powerful figure in China. And particularly at this time, that is not going to happen. Xi Jinping is just not going to want to do that. The other thing right now is that China is extraordinarily casualty adverse. I think Xi Jinping knows that an attack on Taiwan would not be popular among China's people. They couldn't stop it, but I don't think Xi Jinping believes that they would support this. We would see opposition like we're starting to see in Russia. So for a lot of reasons, I do believe the situation is inherently dangerous, but I don't think it's inherently dangerous in 2022. That said, we should always deter China in the Taiwan Strait, but we also need to deter them in the East China Sea with regard to Japan, South China Sea with regard to the Philippines, and of course, with our friend India. So there are so many places where this could go wrong.
That's the key piece.
You know, we've just got to, just got to keep the peace.
Gordon, let me just ask you on that issue of enabling a military officer to become the most powerful man in China. Does that separate political channel that you talked about, that's more important than the military one, not give Xi a confidence that he can exercise control over any such military individual?
Maybe. You know, once he cedes power, you know, it's very difficult for him to get it back. And if Xi Jinping is smart, and this I don't think he is smart, but if he's smart, he should realize that you need a unified line of command in order to engage in any complex military operation. And these two lines of command, which also hobbled the Soviet military, is something that Xi Jinping should be aware of. Unfortunately, he has this view of that is very different from ours, and so that might blind him to the realities of how to launch a combined military operation, land, sea, air.
Gordon, just very quickly, on India, what is it that Xi aspires to do there? Is it a massive territorial grab? Is it a more minimal one, just asserting his strength? Is it fracturing India, breaking off Kashmir? What do you anticipate is the goal? Should they act?
Well, the goal in the short term would be to grab a big portion of India, Arunachal Pradesh, Ladakh. Those are going to be the targets, at least in the first time. Of course, Xi Jinping's view generally, Frank, is that he's the world's only legitimate ruler. So this is, it's making India a colony, which is really his ultimate goal. But he is going after Arunachal Pradesh, which is an enormous area. So let's remember that China is very much in mode of breaking India apart.
There is talk about doing so by breaking off Kashmir in league with Pakistan. And we'll be watching this very closely, as I know will you, Gordon. And thank you for emphasizing this is another possible line of attack for China. Just to come back to Ukraine for a moment, China has been doing a lot, it seems, to buck up Putin and minimize some of the costs of sanctions that have been imposed upon him. How's that working out for both of them?
Well, it's still early days, but clearly China has made it clear to Putin that Beijing is staunchly behind him, especially the statements that we have heard from Wang Yi on Monday, the foreign minister, during the National People's Congress meeting. And that means that we can expect even more Chinese purchases of Russian commodities. Also, China making its financial system available to Russia as Russia is kicked off of SWIFT, have its dollar accounts frozen, all the rest of it. The most recent story that people have been talking about, which is an important one, is that as Visa and MasterCard start cutting Russia off, China's UnionPay is making itself available. That's a credit card which dominates the Chinese financial system. So right now, there is no lack of support we're seeing from China. You know, China talks about a number of things like mediation, but mediation, I believe, is in China's view, is actually helping Russia, giving Russia an ability to get out of this without a complete defeat. So China is working on the diplomatic side of things as well, and it's all in favor of Russia.
In general, are you of the view, Gordon, that we're watching Russia become ever more enthralled to China as a result of this? There are those who say we're watching Russia being driven into the arms of what is far and away the greater danger to us, and that that's a bad outcome here.
Well, certainly Russia is becoming more economically dependent on China, and also from a financial point of view. This was going to happen anyway, Frank, and also there's one possible real advantage for us, and that is that Russia is a basket case, and it could end up being the albatross for China, another situation it has to deal with. But in the short term, this is good for China because it's going to get commodities probably at a discount, and it's going to get support for the use of the renminbi. So at least in the short term, this is going to be very good for China. But, you know, Frank, we don't have a choice. I mean, what do we do? You know, if we don't have sanctions, we don't have a military option, are we just going to allow Russia to annex Ukraine and then move on to some other victim? This is unfortunate. And one point is that misguided policy from American presidents over the course of decades, including all of them, have left the United States with no good options. We have a lot of American presidents to blame for this.
Yeah, of both parties, needless to say. Gordon, lastly, let me turn with you to South Korea. There is an election underway as we speak. About the time this program airs, we may have early returns. What do you expect will come of this balloting, and what are the implications, not just for South Korea, but for us?
The implications are that if the ruling party candidate, Lee Jae-myung, wins, the U.S. alliance with South Korea will be in jeopardy, because Lee will continue the pro-China, pro-North Korea policies that have been in place when Moon Jae-in, the current president, has been in office, which is since May 7, 2017. Right now, it looks like the conservative candidate, the opposition candidate, probably will eke out a small victory, largely because the the minor conservative candidate actually joined forces with Yoon Suk-yeol, the opposition candidate. But in these elections, there was a lot of election fraud in the National Assembly contest. So we just don't know how this is going to come out. Polls are all over the place, though they generally favor the conservative candidate by a small margin.
Well, we'll be watching with bated breath, as Gordon, you and I have talked about in this forum and in others, the likelihood of a win by the radical left would be to further exacerbate, it would seem to me, the interest of the communists, whether they're in South Korea or in North Korea or in China, to fracture the U.S. Republic of Korea alliance and perhaps result, as you've warned, in the removal of American forces from there, setting the stage perhaps for a second invasion of the South by North Korea. Is that still a concern as you see it? And if so, how serious was one?
If Lee wins, Frank, North Korea won't have to invade. They'll get what they want through subversion and through Lee giving them what they want. Moon Jae-in, although he may not be a communist himself, though that's really debatable, has surrounded himself with rapidly pro-North Korean advisors. Moon is a relative conservative compared to Lee, the opposition, the ruling party candidate. So we're really going to be in for hard times if Lee wins.
Heaven help us.
And help us. North Korea won't have to invade.
Yeah, you're right to be warning about the possibility of electoral fraud. I trust that there will be a concerted effort to oppose that and hold people accountable if that eventuates. Gordon, we have to leave it at that for the moment. So much more to visit with you about, and I look forward to doing so with you again next week. Thanks so much for your time today and for catching up with us so handsomely on so many of these fronts. Take good care, my friend. We'll talk with you soon.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back, and a very special welcome to our next guest. His name is Captain Hong Cao, United States Navy retired, a man that I am privileged to say I have just gotten to know in the past few weeks and have been enormously impressed by, not least because of an attribute that we feature on this program and that I think bears the greatest of attention on the part of the largest possible number of Americans. I call it the phenomenon of foreign-born American patriots. Captain Cao, thank you so much for joining us here. It's terrific to have you with us, and I want to thank you both for your past service to our country in the uniform of the United States Navy, as well as your willingness to get into the arena now as a candidate for Congress in the 10th District of Virginia. Welcome, sir. It's good to have you with us.
No, thank you, Frank. This is what an honor to be on your show.
I want to start by talking about this, well, foreign-born American patriot business. You have an extraordinary life story, not unique by any means, but one that really, I think, speaks to the point that I really try to make with this sort of characterization. Namely, you have an appreciation of what freedom is and why this is such an exceptional nation in the sense that it guarantees freedom. Talk a little bit about that against the backdrop of your own circumstances and experiences.
Well, thank you. So at the age of four, my family was allergic to lead, so we had to leave Vietnam pretty hastily. My father was the deputy minister of agriculture, so he was definitely on a hit list to be executed or sent to re-education camp. So my mom was sewing basically little notes into our clothes, into the hem of our clothes. This is my son. Please take care of him. Just a little money. And, you know, just in case we got separated. They had hard decisions to make. You know, they had five children. And at one point, the word was, hey, you know, you might only be able to bring two or maybe three, but not five. So they had to make that difficult choice of which kids do we leave behind. But thankfully, you know, God looked after us, and we were all able to leave and get to Guam. And from Guam, we went to Camp Pendleton. And then a family that that we knew sponsored us in the United States and then brought us to Northern Virginia. Now, my father, again, being in agriculture, couldn't find any work over here. So the only work he could find was in Africa. So then I spent the next 7 years in West Africa, in Niger, and then traveling with him around in Zaire and Cameroon, and then later on in Madagascar. But, you know, just watching, the third world countries and how they appreciate little things in life, like water, right? The basic necessities. And so I had a deep appreciation for that. But the biggest thing I always remember is what Ronald Reagan said. He said, you can go to France, you can go to Germany, and you can go to England, but you'll never be French, you'll never be German, and you'll never be British. I mean, they'll take your taxes and you can become a citizen, but anybody can come to the United States and be an American. And I truly believe that. And that's why I dedicated an entire career in the service of our country to repay a debt that my family could never possibly pay in 10 lifetimes.
Talk a little bit about your service, how it began, and the kind of work that you found yourself doing in the United States Navy.
Sir, I went to the United States Naval Academy and graduated. And then from there, I was one of six people to be selected for the Special Operations Program. So this is a lot different from Special Warfare. Special Warfare is the SEALs. Special Operations is deep sea diving and explosive ordnance disposal, although we work hand in hand, the way firefighters work with EMTs. And so my job as a deep sea diver, I recovered planes and wreckages from the bottom of the ocean. I recovered John F. Kennedy Jr. I recovered the USS Monitor, which is the ironclad from the Civil War, and a few airplane crashes, as well as some of my friends that were pilots that crashed. You know, it was really sad because we had dinner the night before on the carrier. They went back. They went off on a mission and never came back, and I was tasked to recover them. We did a lot of other things underwater as well. But as an explosive ordnance disposal technician, I defuse bombs. You know, that's what we do, and we rendered things safe on the battlefield. I graduated from EOD school 2 days after 9/11, and so at the time they told us, IEDs, that's not something you have to worry about. But that was our fight for the last 20 years.
And you wound up serving on land, worrying about these kinds of problems, notably, I believe, in Afghanistan and Iraq, and also in Somalia. Is that right?
Yes, sir. So in Iraq, I commanded what's called the Combined Explosive Exploitation Cell, SEXI. So we were a forensics team that would go out with FBI, ATF agents, and EOD technicians from all services, and we would piece all the IEDs back together, see how they work, see how we can defend our troops against them, and also get the biometrics and DNA to find the perpetrators and take down the entire network. In Afghanistan, I was the director of counter improvised threats, so that was everything from IEDs to drones that we're seeing now in the Ukraine, and tunneling as well that we're seeing at the southern border.
Indeed. Among other things, you served back in Washington, as I understand it, working about, among other things, the budget of the United States Navy, which gave you, a very high altitude perspective on the challenges facing that service and indeed our military more generally. Is that right?
Yes, sir. So I had two tours in the Pentagon. The first one as a requirement officer, but the second one was in what we call the bullpen. That's where we program and budget the $140 billion budget. And, it's definitely a very challenging job because you had to know there's a balance of everything that you do. If you take away one F-35, what does that mean for the economic water quantity? If you take away, a squadron here or a ship there, how does that affect the entire budget? And so
it gave you a perspective on the subject that I want to turn to next, which is the condition of the, only military that we have at the moment, and what seems to me to be kind of a wrecking operation that is being perpetrated against it, among other aspects of our country, by the Joe Biden administration, and what that means, particularly for, among others, the special operator community that you've served in so gallantly, and therefore the warfighting capabilities and the deterrent capacity of our armed forces in a very dangerous world. We talk about it a lot here. It's clearly getting to be more dangerous by the day. and all the more important, therefore, that we actually have a military that is not degraded, that is not demoralized, and that is capable of performing the vital mission that you, among others, have performed in the past. Captain, I do want to talk with you about how your life story and experiences have informed your assessment of where we are today. You've just published a very important piece in the Washington Examiner called Biden's Fourth Strike, or Four Strikes. Talk a little bit about the nature of the United States military at the moment and the, well, the pressures that it's under from the Biden team.
Yes, sir. So when I went to the Pentagon for that tour, the bullpen, we had ships that couldn't get underway, aircrafts that couldn't fly, and submarines that couldn't dive, which is a bad thing when you're looking at, you know, this great power competition. The last administration worked really hard to fix all that. And then when this administration came in, the focus was no longer on military preparedness. It was more about making sure, you know, they understood the root cause of white rage or whatever it was General Milley said. And we basically crippled our military looking at things that we should not be looking at. You know, we're basically dividing the military and saying, hey, these guys are privileged and these guys are not. And that's not true. You know, in combat, I don't care what you look like, what your gender is, what your orientation is. I just care that you got my back and you can shoot straight. And that's what I think we've lost the sight of is, you know, our country's motto is E Pluribus Unum, out of many, one. And that's how we've led our troops, is that, you know, we're one unit, we fight for one cause. But now the infighting between our service members that's caused really by leadership is I don't know how we're going
to
fix
this. This is the question, I guess, that I wanted to get into with you. This is a function of, I believe, a Maoist doctrine for dividing and conquering nations like ours, not on class warfare lines in this case, but on, well, race lines. And you're a member of an Asian minority population, so you have, I assume, as good a vision of whether this is a systemically racist country as we are told. And if not, whether what's being done is simply inflicting incredible harm on, as I say, the only military we have, and rendering it less capable of fighting the nation's wars. How do you assess that?
You know, I came here I didn't learn English till I was 12. And then I went to the number one high school in the United States, Thomas Jefferson High School for Science and Technology. I went to the Naval Academy. I went to postgraduate school. I have a master's in physics. Then I went to Harvard and MIT. I'm also a Navy captain. So, you know, it's just hard for me to understand where I was held back. I know I had a discussion last night with the NAACP chapter here, and they were pushing the critical race theory. And I said, well, you know, you have to stop dividing us. And, you know, there's things where they say where, well, military kids are privileged. And I don't agree with it, because my kids are definitely not privileged. They've had to move every 18 months. I left my wife when she was 8 months pregnant with our very first child, and not knowing if I was coming back because we're invading Iraq. I had to write him little letters, you know, for all his milestones in his life in case I was killed. And that's not a privileged life. And so when we try to look at different ways to split the United States, well, these guys are privileged, these guys are not, we start fracturing the fabric of what we are, which is like, we are a melting pot. We're just a hodgepodge of different diversities and diversity of thought, diversity of experience. And that's what we need to really concentrate on, is like, hey, I think a little differently from you. And so I have a better idea on this, how to attack this problem or this objective. And that's what we need to concentrate on.
Sadly, it's not just the critical race theory indoctrination and well, the purges that have been taking place by people who, you know, don't exactly embrace it, but also the vaccine mandates now. And in that SEAL community you referred to earlier, we've seen court cases going forward in which the Navy's efforts to purge some of these incredibly highly skilled and highly trained, arguably irreplaceable, you know, servicemen is just, I gather, doing real harm to the fighting trim of those units. Talk, if you would, very quickly, Captain Cao, about what happens when you pull out of these elite units, a single individual or even several, perhaps. Can they maintain the kind of unit cohesiveness that's required for them to perform their mission?
So this is, I think, the biggest Christian purge in the military. I mean, most of these guys are putting in for religious exemptions, which are completely denied. Every single one has been denied. And so, you know, and you're looking at their background, well, they're all Christians. And so we're purging about 13,000 people from the military who believe the same thing. All senior officers or senior enlisted. And that is a problem with our readiness, because these are the people that have been in the teams for a long time. And it takes a while for a team to work and meld together. And now you're pulling a guy out because he refuses to get vaccinated, even though they already have natural immunity from having COVID before.
So very quickly, 30 seconds, your prescription for restoring America greatness and why you're running for Congress for that matter.
Yes, sir. We need to heal this nation by bringing us all together. Stop looking at things that split us apart, but look at all the things that bring us together. And as the greatest nation in the world, where we invented the light bulb, the automobile, the plane, we put a man on the moon, we invented the telephone, the radio, we can do all these things. And so that's why I'm running for Congress. I believe that myself and all the patriots that are running with me want to unite this country the way we united our forces in combat, to look for a common goal so we can strive and continue on as a country.
Well, Godspeed in this vital work, Captain Cao. This is a new act of service to our country, and it's so appreciated because at the end of the day, if we don't have people like yourself getting into the arena and being willing to suffer the slings and arrows, as they say, of advancing the kinds of beliefs and the kinds of ideas that you have, we're doomed. Thank you, sir, for your time today. And
visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
I'm very pleased to have with us to begin a conversation about some of those enemies, a man who, well, for some time was arguably in the enemy camp. He was a Marxist professor at the University of New York, New York University, and has come a long way, baby, in the aftermath of having had the left turn on him, and has become really one of the most, I think, articulate and clear-eyed critics of what the Marxists amongst us are up to. I want to commend to you all an absolutely superb example of Dr. Michael Rechtenwald's work that appeared in the publication of Hillsdale College called Imprimis Magazine. Dr. Rechtenwald, thank you for joining us. Congratulations on this print that goes out to several millions of Americans, and for the chance to have the opportunity to visit with you further about it all. Talk a little bit, if you would, about your personal trajectory and the extent of the danger you think we face at the moment.
Yes. Well, you know, when I first encountered the social justice zealots at NYU, I was really a Marxist at that point. And developments there and their character really took me by surprise and also changed my trajectory. I realized what I was dealing with was a totalitarianism at base, and that, you know, these people were extremely dangerous, in effect, that we were dealing with something that if it spread beyond the university would become an evil that we would have to take care of, that we would have to deal with. And in fact, you know, it has spread beyond the academy. I think it did originate there, and now it metastasized to the entire body politic. And so I think we're dealing with systemic evil, really.
I couldn't agree more. Let's talk a little bit about that evil in the context of what, as you've described in this essay, is the so-called Great Reset. Its character is something that it seems is a function of an unholy alliance between Marxists on the one hand and at least putative global capitalists. Tell us what they've got in mind and how far advanced it is, as you see it.
Yes, well, the Great Reset is a project that was initiated by the World Economic Forum and Klaus Schwab, the chair and founder of it. It is a project to fundamentally alter our economic and political and social system. So what we're looking at is a fundamental change in the nature of capitalism, as they say, a reset of capitalism. And really what it involves is this alliance between the World Economic Forum, corporations, some 1,000 corporate partners, plus the UN, and various governments throughout the world. So they're using, of course, very euphemistic and innocuous sounding language in order to inaugurate what would be a fundamental change to the entire economic and world system. They suggest that it's necessary on the basis of climate change. They say this is all for sustainability, but really there is a command principle at base. And that is, they are dictating to people, companies and individuals, what they must do. And they are effectively aligning with states as well, with governments. And in effect, they're allowing this corporate state partnership to dictate policy that is not democratically decided upon whatsoever. So it really is quite authoritarian.
And this is where I guess you see the convergence between the left on the one hand, the communists in the case of China specifically, for whom these Davos guys seem to have considerable admiration in terms of their model, and yet
yes.
the capitalist dimension of it, I guess, makes more of a fascistic sort of arrangement they have in mind. But whatever it is, it's bad for freedom. That's for sure. And
that's right.
Again, your standing against it is really appreciated, Dr. Reckenwald. Let me ask you about one of the things that I found striking from a government that has been increasingly, it seems, enamored of all of this, namely the administration of Joe Biden here in the United States. As you know, he gave a speech widely billed as the State of the Union. I describe it as the gaslight of the union, because so much of it seemed quite deceptive, dishonest, at least deflecting of attention from the real track record to something very different. How did you see this as a perhaps exercise in the kind of political warfare that you've described?
Yes, this was as you put it, this was a massive gaslighting episode, and an exemplary case of doublespeak, in which Biden was basically suggesting that all the problems that were attendant upon the country now, like the immigration problem, the production problem, the supply chain problem, the inflation problem, that these were all based on policies that had nothing to do with him. In the crimes in the streets, just outrageous crime and criminality. He's suggesting that, we need to fix, we need to fix the border, as if he hasn't been the one responsible for actually opening the border to this complete onslaught of immigrants without vetting whatsoever. It was the most outrageous doublespeak I've seen, and it really is part and parcel of what a pathocracy or dictatorship by psychopaths, frankly, is characterized by. They're characterized by these kinds of gaslighting, doublespeak, and complete inversions of reality.
Yeah. Dr. Recknwald, we only have a couple of minutes left, but when you look at this from the perspective of someone who has been inside the belly of this particular beast, who understands its agenda and who is really very concerned about clearly its continuing progress towards realizing some of its ambitions, if not all of them, to dominate and control the rest of us. What are your most important recommendations about what we do now to counteract all this?
Well, yeah, I think that first of all, we need to resist this kind of euphemistic language that's being put out about environmental, social, and governance scores, and you know the ESG index, which is being applied to corporations in the stock markets, but which will be applied to us as individuals soon enough. We need to point out its character necessarily. We need to show how it is totalitarian at base. We need to keep the free market alive ourselves by engaging in parallel structures that of exchange, parallel economic, parallel media structures like this. We need to keep these and strengthen and fortify them and extend them as much as possible. And we need to resist these ESG scores.
We have to leave it at that. Dr. Recknwald, thank you for your very important insights in this, and we look forward to further updates with you in the future. Keep up the great work, my friend. Come back to us again soon. Next up, we will be speaking with another former leftist about the efforts to take us down from within. Welcome back, and a very special welcome to our next guest. Her name is Carrie Donovan. She has experience, like Dr. Michael Recknwald, with the left. She was, in fact, a community organizer, much as Barack Obama was back in the day. As a result, she has real insights into the nature of what the left is up to, and in particular, wanted to talk a little bit about something that, President Biden tried to persuade us, gaslight us, I think, was his true position on the police, which is that they should be funded, not defunded. Carrie, it's great to have you with us. Talk a little bit about what your investigations of the left's true intentions are with respect to the police, and in particular, a manual that you have found to be pretty illuminating about this, and perhaps about what Joe Biden is up to specifically.
Thanks so much, Frank, for having me. I'm really excited to be here to talk to you about this because I've been trying to get the message out for a long time. I was a community organizer. I worked with U.S. Congressman Howard Wolpe, who was working in the subcommittee for Africa with Jesse Jackson. That's when I really started to learn about the left's plans for the United States was basically what they were doing back starting in 1979 in South Africa. We know how that has, you know, how that has transpired and what's happened, the consequences. In particular, I think that this particular manual, which you made reference to, and it's 146 pages, I think that this manual, which I found about 5 years ago, explains a lot about what the left is doing. And to me, this particular manual explains the grassroots marketing platform, messaging, branding, and PR, a lot of the narrative setting that the left has accomplished through the years. And I like how you said that,
so,
you know, Joe Biden.
This is entitled Organized for Change. And what it basically does is sort of provide a playbook for efforts like this concerning the police. And is it about funding the police or is it about actually trying to dismantle them?
So this particular manual is a step-by-step guide on how to go into local community police departments and defund them using all of the left's tactics that they are very well known for. This manual...
Give us some examples of them.
So in this manual, it tells activists, so regular people, how to use the media to set the narrative, to set the tone by going and finding somebody who's had a bad experience with the police. So we know that from what happened with Trayvon Martin. That's how Black Lives Matter developed. And this manual, which goes back to 2014 and was written by Kamala Harris's sister, Maya Harris, tells them how to take and exploit a situation and use the media, run with it, form the narrative, and then go in, get voters. There's a particular section here on how to get swing voters. So they're focused on elections and using these tactics to change everything. And so the Defund the Police movement has been around for a very long time. I found a reference to things in this manual from 2001 that say this movement goes back a long way. So when Joe Biden says that he's going to fund the police, well, he would be making a massive break with his Vice President Kamala Harris, because as I said, her sister wrote this particular manual right here, which is a policy link. And Joe Biden already has funded policy link organizations. So he is connected to this manual and to the movement.
Carrie, let me just say, Kamala Harris, of course, was very forthright during the presidential campaign about her support for Black Lives Matter, for, the rioters that were taking cities by storm across the United States. And as I recall, she was very explicitly in favor of this defunding the police initiative, much as her sister has been. Just the bottom line, if you would, what is it that they envision happening when they defund the police? What is the larger objective of the left in which this is being put into the service?
Yeah, that's a great question. So in general, what the left wants is that the left claims that the U.S. Constitution doesn't provide equity or equality to their special groups, which is why they have all these different identity groups. What is it that they want? Well, they exploit nonprofits, so they get a lot of money. So they want to make money, and then they want to change our republic into a democracy, or, you know, rule by mob. And this is how they set out to do it. Basically, defunding the police, right, is taking away the police is a great way to get that environment where they can really make a lot of strides in these changes that they want.
Yeah. So we've seen the effects of this in quite a number of cities across the country, this defunding or dismantling or retraining or repurposing or whatever you want to describe it as. And I think it's been a decided disaster for those communities. And it's my sense that that's precisely why President Biden, of course, is now trying to position himself in the State of the Union, at least, as being in favor of funding the police instead. To what extent, and we talked a little bit about this a moment ago with Dr. Recknewald, but in your experience with the left as a community organizer, to what extent is it really important for them to be clear among their own cohort, of course, about what they're doing, witness this manual, but to be opaque wherever possible, to be deceptive towards the rest of the American people so as to conceal their true purposes and the upshot of them?
Yeah, you hit it, the target right on the head, and you called it gaslighting. They're gaslighting us because they tell us what they think we want to hear so that we will let our guard down, so that we will not be vigilant over our liberty, so that we will not push back on them. So they tell us things to comfort us and soothe us. In the meantime, in the back room, the smoky back rooms, they're doing exactly what they've always done. And that is what the left is very, very good at. They use messaging, branding, and PR to tell us what we want to hear, so that we are fighting amongst ourselves about, you know, what they could possibly be up to. And in the meantime, the word is out. They all know. They all have agreed with each other that this is a war against the American Republic. This is a usurpation of our rights and the U.S. Constitution. They've agreed upon it. They're mourning tonight, you know, political activists, and they know that whatever is being said has not been changed. It's just to get us going in a different direction.
this is obviously conducive to success if they've thrown us off the scent and we're either fighting amongst ourselves over, for example, are we a systemically racist nation or not, while they are beavering away at what Barack Obama famously called the fundamental transformation of America. And very quickly, just in a minute or so, Kerry Donovan, what is it that fundamental transformation would entail if it were successful? Not just at the sort of micro level of the police, but the macro level, if you will.
Right. Well, my fear has always been, since going back to working with Jesse Jackson, what really alarmed me was the chaos. And if you look at South Africa, which I think is the model that the Democrats want to usher in to the United States, that there's chaos among the people while the elite are getting rich off of the natural resources in South Africa. So that really frightened me when I was a community organizer and I was a social worker. I went into social work to help people. And when I realized what you're doing is making more of a mess and endangering people and actually stealing their liberty away from them, that's when I got scared and I said, this is not for me. But I think that the ultimate goal of the left is to basically usher in what we see happening in South Africa.
Which is a disaster for one of the most important and once prosperous nations on that continent. And it would similarly, I think it's fair to say, be a disaster for the United States of America, and for that matter, for the free world. Kerry Donovan, we commend you for your coming around on all of this and for the courage you're exhibiting in coming forward and talking about what the true agenda is and why it is so antithetical to the interest of the United States and its people.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. A plausible argument can be made that environmental zealots like Greta Thunberg, the poster girl of a children's crusade aimed at weaning the world off fossil fuels, helped create today's soaring energy prices. Western nations are contemplating intensifying this crisis by ending imports from the principal beneficiary of such green activism and one of its sponsors, Vladimir Putin's Russia. Such a cutoff could actually advance the Green New Deal agenda, namely making oil, natural gas, and their byproducts prohibitively expensive, if the predictable economic train wreck that would follow is to be avoided. Sources and quantities of supply in Europe and here are going to have to be greatly diversified and expanded. Read, reversing virtually all of Joe Biden's ideologically driven energy policies. That includes avoiding creating new and perilous supply chain dependencies on communist China for so-called renewable solar, wind, and battery technologies. This is Frank Affney.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.